The date is October 9th, 1992, and we're watching Under Siege. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Officer Casey Ryback to my 1989 Playboy centerfold Jordan Tate.
All right. Could have been like Stranix and Krill. I guess you want to keep with the
Well,
keep with the good guys, I suppose.
I
But
don't know.
anyways, hello everybody. I'm Colin Stewart.
So to close out our action month here, we have decided to bring back a guest that we talked about having here for Alien, and through happenstance, we discovered that Under Siege might be a better fit for this man. So please welcome back, last seen in our Predator episode, Mr. Luke Bartoszek.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Good to have you back because you've got some stories, and I'm waiting. I can't wait to hear this. But I have to say, Luke, you were adorable when it came to the emails that you had with me. Because I basically told you already had the job. You want to come on for Under Siege? Sure, come on. And you are so grateful that you get to come on for Under Siege. You provided photographic evidence that you should be on for Under Siege. So I can't wait to get into that, but welcome back, Luke. We'll get there in a minute. You know the show. You know when we'll get to you here. So this week we're looking back at October 1992 when the movies and theaters were Last of the Mohicans, School Ties, Captain Ron, subject of episode 33, The Mighty Ducks, and of course our movie for today, Under Siege, which earned $156.56 million on a $35 million budget. That the
Damn.
that's astronomical.
Yeah, that's huge. Well, anyways, if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you like a naked lady in a cake, then please hit pause, go watch the movie, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
So I found two taglines for the poster of this movie. The first one, it's the boring one. In 1992, a battleship's been sabotaged by nuclear pirates out to steal its warheads. Now surrounded by terrorists, a lone man stands with a deadly plan of attack. That's more a
Okay.
log line than it is a tagline. That's a lot of description. But the second one, I mean, straight into the point. It's not a job, it's an adventure.
I feel like we had that for one recently.
Maybe, but
That seems, I don't know, it seems too familiar.
he also quotes that as
Oh,
the
right, he does, yeah.
tagline
Maybe.
for the Navy. So you're saying the tagline for this movie is just plagiarizing the Navy.
I guess so. I wonder if they got permission to use it.
I hope so. I don't know.
Do we know for a fact that that's the Navy, that was or is the Navy's like recruitment
I
taglines?
have no idea. Luke, any idea?
I have no idea either.
No? Yeah, okay. Well, either way, I mean, the first tagline tells us a good amount, but not enough. So let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
All right. A group of mercenaries led by a rogue CIA operative named Stranix execute a Trojan horse-style siege of the recently retired USS Missouri battleship with the help of the Missouri's executive officer, Commander Krill, during the ship captain's surprise birthday party. Stranix and crew capture the ship, kill the captain, and take the crew hostage, leaving only the ship's cook, Casey Ryback, and a Playboy playmate named Jordan Tate to save the day. Fortunately, The captain's favorite chef also happens to be a former Navy SEAL, and his knife handling skills go beyond the kitchen. Ryback sets about making the hostile takeover more difficult for Stranix and Krill than they anticipated, eventually killing them both and saving nearby Honolulu from being taken out by two of the Missouri's Tomahawk missiles.
From glowing in the dark. Don't want it to glow.
From glowing in the dark.
Oh boy. Yeah, Under Siege. I mean, I remember when Steven Seagal was cool. My dad really liked Steven Seagal. And, you know, so there was a time that Steven Seagal was definitely very, very, very bankable. And Under Siege was one of those movies that I remember liking a lot. I'm pretty sure I even saw it in theaters. I would have been 14 years old. I remember distinctly two scenes, though, from this movie that just from my childhood that all these years later, it's been a while since I've seen Under Siege. I was excited to revisit it. But there were only two scenes that I truly remembered, and one was the obvious cake scene, and the other one was the knife fight at the end. But I even forgot that it was with Tommy Lee Jones. I forgot Tommy Lee Jones was in this movie. So, Under Siege, I liked it when I was young, I forgot it, and now I'm back in this world. I can't wait to talk about this movie. But Luke, I embarrassed you quite a bit there, but it's true. You really are excited to talk about this movie, and you have met the man in question. So I gotta know, I mean, tell us what about your childhood and about this photograph that I alluded to, and also, which version of Steven Seagal did you meet? Did you meet like ponytail Steven Seagal or this Steven Seagal, or did you meet like fat, angry Steven Seagal, or like, you know, Sheriff Steven Seagal, like actual real world cop Steven Seagal? Which
friend
version
of,
did you
friend
meet?
Of Putin Steven Seagal?
I mean, it would have been somewhere between the fat ponytail and friend of Putin. So it was in, okay. It was in 2017 that I met Steven Seagal, and it was by extraordinary chance. So just to give you a little bit of background here, the impact that this movie had on my life can hardly be overstated. There are going to be people listening to this podcast who know me well, be wondering how much of my life was building up to this exact moment. This was one of the first movies that we got on VHS as a family. And mm-hmm. I mean, as Sean was saying there, this was a time when Steven Seagal was still cool. Like there were still
very
movies
cool.
That were being kicked out by him that were
so cool,
objectively pretty good. And this was by far the best. So I grew up as a Steven Seagal fan. Unlike Sean's dad, though, my dad wasn't a fan of his. But I watched this movie countless times. It was on in the background. I'm sure my poor parents probably knew the script as well as I did, because it was what I wanted to watch and was in the player all the time. And to give you some idea of how much it influenced me, like I thought I tried to grow my hair out into a ponytail to be like Steven Seagal. My most prized piece of clothing was he wears a black fleece in a few scenes. I was like, I got to get me a black fleece. So I got my parents to get me one, and I wore that all the time. The picture that I sent Sean was one of the few pictures of my childhood when I was sort of playing outside with some of my sort of young friends, and I'm holding up the VHS copy that I have in the garden. It doesn't make any sense. I'm out in the garden, holding up my VHS copy.
It's amazing.
I'm so proud of it.
Like it was like your security, like it was a security movie. Like you just brought it around with you, like
around
a teddy bear.
Some kids had a blanket or a teddy bear. I was carrying around that movie.
Like, did you ever go to anyone's house and be like, hey, I happen to have this tape. Anyone want to watch Under Siege?
I was going
to
say.
Like, did you carry it around to other, a roaming movie that you got going on around the neighborhood?
I'm just imagining Luke like an evangelist, like just rolling around.
Have you
heard the good news of Steven Seagal?
Yeah.
Well, weirdly enough, I did take it to a friend's house whose father was in the British SAS. He was in the Special Forces, and of course we were watching it when he was there, and he came in during one of the scenes. I hope we're not jumping ahead of ourselves, where he's shooting with the submachine guns like crossed in
the cross-armed,
which I'd never seen in a movie before, and I don't think
probably
I have
never will again. I think he owns that.
Yeah. Anyway, so of course, I was quite in awe of my friend's dad because he was in the British Special Forces. He was a captain in the SAS. And he came in as the scene was playing. And he didn't sort of write it off. He just sort of came in and watched it. And he went, that's pretty cool. And walked out of the room again. Mm-hmm. And that totally legitimized it for me. I was like, okay, this is legit. This is totally cool. Steven Seagal's a man. I definitely like embarrassed. Like, I can think of one occasion I definitely embarrassed my friends. I also wanted to learn to throw knives because of that scene, and I managed to get a hold of a throwing knife, but I obviously needed a piece of wood to throw it into, and I dragged one of my friends down to the Home Depot or whatever shop, and I was trying to explain to the salesperson that I needed a piece of wood, but I didn't want to say exactly what it was for. So I launched into this like absurd explanation about how I was doing a science experiment at school, and I needed to test the grippiness of wood. And anyway, I can remember the look on the face of the young shop clerk as I was just obviously just babbling bullshit is the only would be the only appropriate way to describe it.
You know, you could have just said, I'm hanging up a dartboard at home and my mom told me to get a piece of wood to put behind it so I don't destroy the drywall.
Sean, I wish I'd known you then to suggest that.
You should have just told them you were trying to make like a porn bulletin board, and that probably would have worked.
That would have, you know, that would have been better than what I said. I mean, any way you cut it, that would have been better. I come out of the store with my piece of wood, and my friend just turned, it's like I could just see the look on his face. He's just like, "What happened in there?" Like that guy. We were about 11 years old, and my friend was going like, "That guy is going to think you're completely crazy for the rest of your life." And I was like, "Yeah, probably, yeah." So yeah, no, this film had a big impact on me, and he's the ramp up to this is you know, I love movies. I'm already somewhat nervous about what Colin's opinions are going to be about this in case. In case there's a huge falling out follows by the end of this podcast.
Okay, so now let's fast forward to you meeting the man, the myth, the legend. This was in Vegas, I believe you said.
Stage for how this influenced me. So I was at the 2017 SHOT Show. At the time, I was working for a company in Edmonton, and we went down to Vegas together. And the SHOT Show is like a big guns and gear show that happens in Vegas every year. It's a huge event.
Okay.
It happens in a big hotel, and I wasn't expecting to see any celebrities or famous people there in Vegas. That's not why we were there. We were just there to do purchasing basically and make some industry connections.
Yeah.
And at some point, I split off from the group while they went to lunch to go and visit a booth that I wanted to see that they didn't in the basement of the hotel. So I split off from them, and there was a long escalator, and I kind of was in a hurry. So I went bounding down the escalator, not really paying attention to who was around me. And at the bottom of the escalator was like this sort of entourage, like a sort of almost like a sort of security circle. And just because of the way that I came down at that exact moment, I like came straight through the side of it. And as I came around, I kind of noticed like these security guards or security type people like sort of turn around and face me with a kind of look of like, where the heck did you come from?
Are you a threat?
Yeah, are you a threat? Like, you know, jackets were reached under or whatever. And then I turned and I faced, and there's Steven Seagal. It's like right in front of me. I was immediately, of course, starstruck. I wasn't expecting to run into my childhood hero. He's a big, tall man. He was quite pudgy and overtanned, and he had a ponytail. We kind of made eye contact. I kind of froze, and then I just said to him, I really love your work, and shook his hand, and he shook mine, and he put his hand over mine, and he couldn't have been nicer and more charming. Like, all these stories I've heard about what a jerk he is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In that moment, like, I guess I was lucky enough not to experience any of that. He was super nice to me, and he said, thank you very much. And then there was a kind of pause.
You burst into the middle of his entourage, right, and caught him by surprise. I mean, he was just surprise. Like, you weren't wielding a knife. You know, he's like, okay, hey, nice meeting you. Yeah.
And there was a kind of an awkward pause. And then I realized I really didn't have anything beyond that to say to him. You know, I didn't think to ask for an autograph or a selfie. Because and I mean, there was obviously, it wouldn't have been good for me to ask him to go for lunch or anything. So, so I took it on, and then I sort of stepped back and I was like, oh, well, I've got to go now. And he was like, okay, see you later. And all of his security looked so annoyed, and I just sort of scarred away between them. And then
cool.
it kind of caught up
cool,
with me.
Cool, I gotta go.
It came back, it kind of caught up with me a minute later, like what had just happened. And I called my mom and I was like, mom, the weirdest thing just happened. I just met Steven Seagal. And she went, oh my God. You know?
Do you have a picture? And you're like, shit.
That's exactly what she said. And that was exactly my reaction. And I was like, oh no, I've never wanted to take a selfie with anyone before, like a celebrity, and I've missed my opportunity. I look back, and of course, like his security guard, now they're wise to it. They've closed ranks. Nobody's getting through again to meet him. And
they closed off the weak spot from the escalator.
Yeah, absolutely. The escalator, they moved away from the escalator. There was a man stationed probably at the bottom of it. So that was my
right
meeting.
On.
Yeah.
Oh, that is awesome. Oh, well, okay, so Colin, any experience with Under Siege? Tell me about all the times you've met Steven Seagal and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I can't say that I've met Steven Seagal. Yeah, I think I mentioned this at the end of the last episode, but like the only Steven Seagal movie I'd watched until now was the movie Half Past Dead, where he's like in a prison with Ja Rule. And it's a pretty sweet movie. It's like it's good enough that I bought it and like enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But I kind of missed the era where like I feel like people would have called Steven Seagal cool.
Oh yeah.
I feel like by the time that I was like more aware of him, I thought more fondly of like Schwarzenegger and Stallone. I kind of considered like Van Damme and Seagal the like B level, like cartoonish action heroes. So yeah, never seen this movie before. Really, the only thing I knew about Steven Seagal was he had that weird fighting style that looked like he was slapping people, but I don't really feel like that came into play in this movie all that much.
Not so,
I don't
much
know.
No, he translated it into holding knives, I think.
Yeah. But I did laugh every time he holds a knife, because anytime I've ever done like any sort of defensive tactics training where we have like knife like we do like knife work or whatever, like I can see like everybody defaults into that Steven Seagal like Filipino knife fighter stance. So
Alrighty, well, here we go. Let's jump into Under Siege. Oh, actually, one last question for Luke. Where does Under Siege 2 Dark Territory fall?
I mean, it really was an abomination to come off the back. You know, it's a very difficult, you know, thing in movies or music to catch lightning in a bottle too. Like I mean, Under Siege isn't just the best Steven Seagal movie, in my opinion. It's by a very long way. You know, there's no real like close second or third. You know, there's having such a good director, cinematographer, I mean, just really, and I think that one of the key things was that Steven Seagal really didn't seem to take himself very seriously in this movie, unlike the other one. I would say that's other ones, that's a very separating sort of characteristic, as he seems quite sort of laid back and charming and is joking around, which you don't really see in the other Steven Seagal movies, which is unfortunate because it clearly pays dividends, and I'm sure we'll get more into that as we go through the conversation.
Well, here we go. Let's jump into Under Siege. Directed by Andrew Davis, who is the director of Holes. And then, like, the very next year, The Fugitive, which has 9 of the actors from this film, including, of course, Tommy Lee Jones. But, yeah, so, you know, he went on to some really big stuff, too. I guess Under Siege got his foot in the door for The Fugitive. Produced by Joel Chernoff, Arnon Milchan, and Steven Ruther, and Steven Seagal, and written by J.F. Lawton, who is the writer of Pretty Woman, Chain Reaction, but Mike Gray, John Mason, and also, of course, Steven Seagal have uncredited rewrites, because I don't think Steven Seagal would have it any other way. He's someone that really likes to have his fingers in every little bit of the movie and co-stars, by the sounds of it, if he can.
What?
Well, I guess Pamela Anderson was actually up for the role of the stripper of Jordan, and it was a very casting couch type situation that she refused to do and spurned his advances. But then I guess he was constantly trying to get a sex scene put in with this movie. I already feel like it's weird that he kisses her at the end, and then, like, apparently, yeah, he was trying to get a little extra action. So yeah, Steven Seagal, not necessarily the nicest guy. He has a very bad reputation, despite Luke's, like, really great meeting with him. He really does have a bad reputation with things.
Yeah, I can't pretend that my interaction with him was probably in any way typical, and I certainly, of course, heard those stories, and I was actually the primary reason my dad didn't like him was because he was quite aware of these stories too, with the casting couches and the general acting out on set. And I think that I get the impression that he sort of spiraled quite a bit after this movie.
Oh, I think he lost his mind, man. I mean,
I'm glad that there was at least a moment where he was able to contribute to this before that all started to happen.
Like it's weird that in the end, out of all the people that are in this movie, Gary Busey is not the one that went the most off the deep end.
Yeah.
quite a bar, isn't it?
Right. So this movie was originally supposed to be a movie called Dreadnought. I guess it went through a lot of titles before it actually landed on Under Siege. And so Law at Sea was one possibility.
Some kind of crime drama. That can only end with somebody walking the plank.
That's right. Out for a Swim. This one, I like this one. Deep Blue Chef. Ocean Justice. Yeah, Deep Blue Chef.
Deep Blue Chef sounds like the type of movie title that would be in a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, or like it's like Blue Apron. It's like a food delivery kit now. The Deep Blue Chef. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ocean Justice. Marked at Sea. Kung Fu Cook, which was Steven Seagal's preferred title. Ship of Fools. Last Siege. And Battleship Shenanigans. Those were all the titles that they like filtered through before landing on Under Siege.
I feel like this movie could just retroactively be named Battleship to replace like the terrible Battleship movie that they made with what's his face, Taylor Kitsch.
Yeah, that's right, because they do sink a submarine. So
exactly.
So we open the movie looking out over sea, and then we see a battleship sailing by. I love the shot out of the dolphin jumping in front of the warship. It's a neat image.
It's a great opening sequence, right? You have this huge, powerful ship, but it actually pans out over the ocean. It gives you a sense of the remoteness of you know, the vast sea and them heading out onto it. And then, yeah, the little dolphin swimming alongside sort of adds a lighter touch to it. I think it's a great, even from the first shot, it's great before the music kicks in.
Yeah,
it's got a good, it's a very calming opening, but by the time you get to the title sequence, like, you know, business is about to pick up.
That's right.
I was also thinking that I'm impressed by how much this movie, for like not being factual, like uses real things. Yeah. Like that the USS Missouri was a real thing. And even that they had, like, I'm sure it's just like spliced from something. I don't know if like George W. Bush or H.W.
H.W.
Bush would have been.
That's George Senior. Yeah.
Like if he would have had like a credited role in this movie, or if it's just like spliced images from other things. But it's very rare, like now, that you ever see a real like sitting president be the president in a movie.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was impressed by that too. And like, I mean, that's not the only thing. Like the story that he tells about Panama is based on a true story, and the audio from when the ships are, or sorry, the planes are shot down is real audio from two F-14s that were shot down by Libyan MiGs. back in 1989. Like, they're using real things. Like, they did everything they could do to, like, lend as much authenticity to this movie for some reason. Like, it's just not something that you would expect, especially out of a Steven Seagal movie. Yeah. That they would be like, we got to get this right.
Yeah, and I believe it was actually Steven Seagal that suggested using footage from the Pearl Harbor anniversary, because they knew that there would be a lot of...
You wanted to say celebration, but you're like, no, that's word. Wrong. That's the wrong word.
But when you see like...
Commemoration.
Commemoration. That... it was actually his suggestion to use footage from all those battleships in one place and being gathered there. So again, you get like real footage of like the US Navy and all their big ships and sort of that projection of military power in one space. So that was quite a shrewd move to take advantage of that. And as you say, I think it really lends something to the film to use these real footage or stock footage as part of the movie.
It
grounds it a little bit.
Yeah, it's just weird not to have like some, you know, random President Archer or something, you know. it is weird. It's definitely surprising to see. Yeah. But let's run down this cast quickly. I mean, we've been talking about our big man. Let's see who else we got in this movie.
Okay, we'll skip over Steven Seagal and go to Tommy Lee Jones as William Stranix.
Tommy Lee Jones. Unhinged Tommy Lee Jones in this movie. Oh my God.
Just fantastic. Yeah,
shades of Two-Face.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. The energy that he brings to this role too. You know, he really, when he's interacting with the crew and he's first on the ship, and he really does seem like the front man for a band.
Rock band. Yeah. Band.
He really brings that sort of almost sort of manic energy, as you say, and is able to pivot so well to his sort of leadership roles, and it's sort of the jokes that he's cracking in it just delivered so well.
And it's interesting because so often I think of Tommy Lee Jones as like Men in Black Tommy Lee Jones. Like, I think of him as deadpan and serious and all that, but here and Two-Face, like, he's unhinged and manic, and it's just not something you think of with Tommy Lee Jones. But it's like, oh no, that's the stuff that kind of built his career, you know. Like, he follows this up with The Fugitive, which is, he's the complete opposite in The Fugitive, but that's the Tommy Lee Jones I think of, not this one, but he does it well.
Yeah, it's interesting you sort of point that out, that sort of Steven Seagal plays a character that's quite departed from his other roles in this movie. And the same is, it's kind of true of Tommy Lee Jones. It's kind of like the director was really able to sort of coax out very different characters that really work in this movie that you don't really see in other ones.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I was blown away when he showed, because I didn't realize obviously like what was happening with the band. I don't know. I didn't clue in that they were going to end up being the bad guys right away. I just thought they were a band. And when I was like, oh, that's Tommy Lee Jones. That was, my brain could not like put it together, like to see him. I can't see him as that character in that type of role. But then also, I don't know how old he is in this movie, but he's one of these guys who like always looks old. Mm-hmm. Like even today, like he doesn't look that far removed from now, or maybe I haven't seen him in a while, but it's just, I was like, he's one of those where I'm like, when were you young? Like, what is it? What is young Tommy Lee? What's a young Tommy Lee Jones movie? I need to find one.
I didn't write it down, but I looked it up too, because I had exactly the same thought, which was like, how old is he where he has this much energy? And I think, I didn't write it down, but I think he was just in his sort of mid-40s. So.
Okay.
Ooh. Nice. Wow, I mean, I'm glad I don't have those lines in my mid-40s then in my face.
Yeah, I wish I had that energy in my early 40s. <too. laughs>
Yeah, we got Gary Busey as Commander Krill.
As you know, yet another crazy person. I mean, anytime we've seen him on this show, he's been the same guy.
Yeah. Erica Eleniak, she plays Jordan Tate.
And she is the actual Miss July from 1989. So I don't understand why they made the character fictional if they're using her real centerfold in the movie. Like, why change her name? You know, her story is the same. I'm an actress. I, you know, like, it's why'd you make her Jordan then? You should have just made her Erica.
For sure. Yeah. I don't know why. I guess maybe they didn't want her to have to be like as herself, and then people would expect her to like have some sort of military skills or some sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe she just really wanted to like try to get into character. She's trying to make it as a real actress.
Well, she is a Baywatch girl, so
this would just be a step.
Yeah.
Holm Meany is Dahmer. Stranix is Lead Commando. Is that the? No, that's not the black guy.
No, it's the guy we saw in Con Air. We saw him in Con Air. He's Agent O'Brien from Star Trek: The Next Generation. He's the curly haired. He's in the tuxedo in the first scene.
Okay.
Yeah.
Patrick O'Neill is the captain. Andy Romano is Admiral Bates. Dale Dye is Captain Nick Garza. Nick Mancuso is Tom Breaker. Damien.
I don't even remember who he is.
Damien Chapa is Pac-Man. Tom Wood is Private Nash. Troy Evans is Granger. I'm not really recognizing any of these people.
Yeah, well, like Troy Evans is
Kane Hodder. I know him. That's Jason Voorhees.
Troy Evans is someone who was an actual Navy guy and switched to acting. I guess he had enough of Steven Seagal's shit and told him off in the middle of the set one day.
Oh, I was trying to remember where I recognized that guy. He's in Ace Ventura.
Which guy?
Troy Evans.
Oh, and
he's one of the cops.
And isn't he also in Demolition Man?
Let's see. Yeah, he is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's one of these guys that I always think of as Gary Shaddix, Ortho from Beetlejuice.
Okay.
They remind me of each other. I don't know.
It's definitely one of my favorite things about this movie is the casting. Like, everyone just seems to fit really well with the role that they have.
Delivers
a stellar performance. I mean, from the moment Patrick O'Neill's on the screen, he comes across as so, like, a sort of really awesome grandfather that anyone would love to have, and you instantly like him. You know, he's on it for a very, very short period of time, but he just comes across immediately as, like, the caring captain of a big ship. And then by the time he gets killed, you're like, oh no, you could relate with Steven Seagal, yeah, where he's staring straight into the camera for some reason, unhappy about what's just happened. He's bound, so.
Yeah, I think, do we want to just cut it off there? I don't know anyone else in this cast.
I mean, no, I don't feel, many people went on to hugely bigger and better things after this, except Tommy Lee Jones.
I know with what you were saying, you know, there with everyone was just so fantastically cast. I mean, you know, I even think about like the table of generals.
Right.
You know, seeing all those guys sitting around, you look at that and it's like, man, that would be you just don't see that many old guys sitting around in a movie. Like, it actually had me thinking for some reason that I was just, all those guys are just sitting there playing dress up in their uniforms, you know, like, but they all looked the part.
Right. It's funny, in those scenes, I could never stop looking at the one woman who's like taking notes behind the one general.
Well, and what's funny is apparently that particular war room is set up exactly the same as the one in Doctor Strangelove.
Okay.
It's like an homage to that movie. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, big Kubrick fan, I guess, this director is. I don't know. Yeah. So yeah, we end up meeting our hero for the movie. He's the ship's cook. He's loved by everyone that's below his rank and hated by everyone that's above his rank, except for the captain. That's the only reason he gets to hang around is because the captain loves him for some reason.
Yeah.
I mean, he can make anything anyone desires. He's the ultimate chef, right?
So on the rewatch, something really jumped out at me, which was that when he's speaking with the captain, or the captain's introduced, he says, "I've got 50 gallons of beef bouillon to prepare." And,
okay, yeah. Bouillon base,
Bouillon base. And yeah. And I'm a bit of a foodie. So I thought there may be some sort of mistake or misheard it.
Yeah,
So I downloaded the script, as you know, a normal healthy person would do.
Completely healthy, yeah.
Yeah, and I found out that actually what he'd said was, I'm probably going to hash up the pronunciation of this, was beef.
Yeah, bouillabaisse, right?
Bouillabaisse. Bouillabaisse.
Yeah.
So I Googled that, and it turns out that what Wikipedia tells me is that that is a traditional provincial French soup originating the port city of Marseille.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's not even just a soup broth. It's like a disgusting sounding soup broth.
Yeah, it's like a provincial soup.
So it's I guess hoity-toity. It's fancy. It's fancy shit.
Fancy shit.
Yeah.
I grew up in the kitchen. I also went to a boarding school, so I know what guys like to eat when they're in a big group or when there's mass cooking happening.
Yeah.
And this kind of stayed with me. I started thinking, like, what on earth could he be trying to prepare with 50 gallons of beef bouillon that the crew would like to eat?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, soup stock. Yum.
Yeah. Soup stock. So this kind of stayed with me a bit. And then I couldn't figure it out. So I, losing a couple of nights sleep, I called a friend of mine who's a US Marine. And he's done a few tours on boats.
Yeah.
And I asked him. He said the only thing that they liked when they were offered it was burgers or pizza.
Oh, really?
So again,
that's what you gotta have, right? Like, you need something hearty if you're out at sea.
Basically.
Right, right. Yeah. And also, these are U.S. Marines and Navy servicemen, right?
Yeah, comfort food.
Comfort food, exactly. And I feel like the curtain of realism was, at this moment, was ripped back for me. Like,
I'd say it was, yeah.
There was a serious script error there. It's kind of stayed with me. I think, Sean, that on this discovery, a little something died in me.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. I mean, you know, especially considering you have already told us how impressed your cop friend or whoever it was with the gun handling skills of the cross arm gun of Steven Seagal. And
right.
It was that moment that you said, this shit is legit. And now all of a sudden that's just been fractured for you once again, because of the cooking.
Because of the cooking.
So Steven Seagal shouldn't be a cook in a movie.
I guess not, or at least the script needs some, clearly, they didn't hire a consultant, is all I got to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah, he needs to be able to make a hell of a burger. That's what that should be his special skill.
Indeed. He can't, you know, Steven Scully can't salute. His medals are all on wrong. And now they really need to bring in a consultant, I think, to help him out with some of this stuff.
Gonna feed this entire ship a provincial fish soup.
I love it. So good.
But he's a humble man. You know, he doesn't want any special treatment. He doesn't want to meet the president, even though he could if he just put on some dress whites. Yeah, he's just a cook.
He's a man of the people.
And again, it's such a departure from the other Seagal movies, right? He's sort of very charming and sort of joking around with his peers. And as you say, he's quite humble and respectful when he's interacting with the captain and stuff like that. It just comes across as a really charming, likable guy. But
I do really struggle with his line delivery. Mm. Like, it's just how he does it. You know, like he takes himself a little, like, I don't know, it's he takes himself a little too seriously, or I just, there's something about his delivery that is just like, ah, oh, I just can't get over it. I struggled with it, where I'm just like, oh, he's a cheesy as fuck.
Well, it has like a weird, like, I've heard people discuss his kind of like, I don't know, ethnic, like he has this weird ethnic ambiguity. Like, I can't tell what he is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is he Native American? Is he Mexican? Like, is he Italian? I don't know. Like, he has like a little, like,
is
sometimes
love
he has
of martial arts. Does he have some sort of Asian in him? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, like sometimes he has that, like, I don't know, that stereotypical kind of like, not Spanish, but that, like, how you see in like movies with like Mexican people, that little like growl, that little growly whisper thingy that he does. But
yeah.
I think it adds to his coolness, though. My one thing about Casey in this movie is that I can see the coolness of Steven Seagal in that, like, even though his line deliveries are weird, it is kind of this thing, like, he just doesn't care. Like, he just couldn't be bothered. Yeah. That's kind of how he seems the whole way. Like,
I just want to cook.
Yeah,
I
just
want to
cook.
20 days left.
Yeah. Like, I was expecting to watch this movie and it be more like over the top fringe. But he kind of toes the line and just stays cool. So I was fine with
He goes right up to that line, but
it.
I have to say he has a very hazardous chopping method, though. I don't know if I like his chopping method, but it's just to show that he's great with a knife, though, right?
Yeah, so our first little insight that he's not, there's something about him. Like he's chopping up those carrots like so fast. I agree. My mum was a cook for when I was growing up. I never saw her cut carrots like that. I can't ever think when it would be necessary to cut carrots that quickly.
You plant the tip and cut with the back. I mean,
Right,
you
right.
use a sawing motion that way. Yeah,
It's
I've
for
worked in kitchens.
amateurs.
It's just our first little glimpse into he may not just be a lowly cook after all.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, we knew that as soon as we saw that it was Steven Seagal.
I mean, it's definitely there is a. I do appreciate the sort of little build up and hints, to who he might be when the captain says to him, if I had your ribbons, I'd wear them to bed. And it's not really sort of expanded upon or dwelled upon.
Like he basically like when Krill like comes after their little meeting and is like bullying him, and he like basically t beats those five guys single-handedly and like pretty much just lets them like throw him in the freezer or whatever. There's things like that too. Like I agree. Like I appreciate these like subtle little you as the viewer, it's Steven Seagal, so like what he can do, but like story-wise, they do a lot of these like tiny just little like pieces to show you, oh, like there's more to this guy before he, goes full Navy SEAL. Or even when he's talking to the private that's like left to guard him or whatever about the gunshots and like trying to get him to go to figure out what's happening and stuff.
Just call. I'm not asking you to do let me out. Just go call them. Make sure everything's okay. Are you stupid? Those are gunshots. I do have to say that when he does punch Gary Busey, that cut is terrible. That is some bad makeup. You can see the seams. You can see the entire prosthetic there. Someone didn't finish the makeup on that one, I don't think.
Fooled me. I didn't see it.
Well, and then for the rest of it, he's wearing a band-aid, so it doesn't matter after that anyway. But he takes on the five guys single-handedly because they don't want him at the party and they don't want him talking to the captain. They can't put him in the brig. Putting him in the brig requires a signature from the captain, so they put him in the freezer, and we get the "another cold day in hell" line. That's a great one. That would have been a great tagline for this movie. Oh my God, another great day, another cold day in hell. Absolutely.
Yeah, after the movie like progresses a little bit, I really like question Frill's like thought pro like I get that later on he's all like, well, I didn't have his file, I didn't know who he was, blah blah blah. But like you're about to like kill the captain and all these other people, like why wouldn't you have just like
Shot him then.
killed Casey first? Like clearly you have beef and just do not like the man. But it's just one of those like weird,
Well, I had the same question later on with Tommy Lee
The villain's
Jones.
undoing.
Tommy Lee Jones gives him the opportunity to have a knife fight with him when he could have just put one between the eyes as soon as he walked in that room. I mean, well, when he is in the freezer, like you know what they had in there? A big box of sponsorship corner. There's actually very little this week. Last time Luke was here, there were no sponsors, I don't think. This time doesn't do much better, but always on the lookout for product placements in movies. This week, Under Siege is brought to you by Dole. There were just a bunch of Dole boxes in there. I don't think he was in a freezer, wasn't he? What would have been Dole that would have been frozen? Like, would they have kept all their fruits frozen?
I think it was more like a fridge, not necessarily like a freezer, like just like a cold storage. So they could have had like I don't know, some applesauce or some fruit cups.
Well, there we go. Magnavox, Mineral Spirits Paint Thinner, and Playboy Magazine. And for some reason, the galley of the ship seems to have a name as well. It's the Missouri Express Whistle Stop. I don't know. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. Yeah, very light on the sponsors.
I don't think anyone was expecting the movie to be such a runaway success as it was. It
Yeah, I
it
don't
was
think so, yeah.
very low budget, very big return. I believe at the time it was the most successful film ever that hadn't been sent out for pre-screening. So yeah, with hindsight, I'm sure there might have been a few sponsors if they'd were aware of how popular the film would be.
It's just like, man, we could have had all the guys drinking Budweiser at the party. Like, no, instead they have, like, fruit punch.
Luke, I should have asked. I know you're a well-traveled man. Have you ever visited the Missouri?
When I was rewatching this movie, I really regretted not having gone to see it. I would definitely, it will become one of my new life goals will be at some point to go and tour the Missouri as it's now a museum for sure. But most of the scenes filmed inside it were actually filmed on the Alabama, I believe. So
Yes,
I'll have to
yes, they
visit
were.
often.
I was actually just scrolling through my notes looking for that bit of trivia. Yes, they were. Yeah, it's the biggest challenge they had was that they couldn't take the Alabama out. So they had to somehow trick you into thinking it was actually out in the open ocean as well, which had a series of just big black screens that they had it on a barge so that they could move it to block off cities and different scenes and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
Have either of you toured a battleship or been inside a submarine or anything like
No.
Other than the ones at West Edmonton Mall, no.
Canada's submarines at West Edmonton Mall.
At one point there were, yeah.
I'm being honest, like submarines kind of scare the shit out of me. I don't know how, like, of all the, like, I wouldn't want to be in the military really in any capacity, but I don't know how people join the military and choose to do like submarine
You're like,
tours.
I can handle being in the air in a big metal tube, but under the water in a big metal tube, nah.
No, it just seems like I don't know how long they're like down there for at a time, but I just feel like I'd go crazy. Like that's the thing that like horror movies are made of, but.
Yeah. And everything's just so tight and cramped, yeah. So our party is about to arrive. They're going to have a party for the captain. It's his birthday, and we meet all of our guys on the helicopter. So you were completely thrown off. You had no idea that they were going to come in and be the bad guys of this at all, eh, Colin?
Yeah, no, I didn't know.
Did you have a
I don't know
guess before
what.
this movie of what, like, 'cause I know sometimes you do that.
Not really. Like I knew that like he was gonna have to save the ship, obviously, from terrorists of some sort. But for some reason when I saw Tommy Lee Jones, I was like originally, I was like, he just seems like such a nice guy, like he can't be the
He's gonna be like an
bad guy.
accidental victim of.
I thought it was I honestly thought it was all gonna be Krill, and I thought it was gonna be the dude that like kind of leads us into the war room. I can't remember what that guy's name was, but I thought he was gonna be end up being the like big bad guy, kind of like orchestrating things like from the inside.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely criticisms I have of this movie. And one of them might be that when they're flying in, the caterers absolutely do not look like caterers to me. They look like terrifying mercenaries. I don't understand how when that, I think that they had to bring Erica on the helicopter because if they didn't have that sort of focus point of attention, if they noticed these massive, burly, thick-necked, shaved head guys who were there apparently to cook some food
That
and play some
was me. I
music.
was gonna say, I noticed nobody other than her and Tommy Lee
I think the jig
Jones.
would have been up immediately if she hadn't been on the Chinook, so.
Well, and that's the other reason why you bring Kulmini in on your in your crew as well, because he's unassuming and he looks harmless as well. So, yeah, you have these two soft people beside all these rugged, thick-necked guys, yeah. But yeah, I mean, this movie, I think one of the reasons why it is so great is because it's basically Die Hard in a boat. Because once he escapes, that's what he's got. I mean, he does put together a team eventually. He gets more sidekicks than John McClane ever does, but it is basically Die Hard in a boat.
I'm going to disagree with you there, Sean. I know that's often something I've heard over the years bandied about. It's like it's Die Hard in a boat, but I think it's way more than than that. As you say, there's you know, the character development is much more in Under Siege. And as you say, he puts together his own crew, and there's just so much more going on. Like, I find it's much more simplistic Die Hard, and the stakes are much lower. Those guys are there to steal some money.
That's true.
You know, the threat of Hawaii being nuked is totally different from whether or not these guys are going to get away with some barrel bonds or what's ever supposed to be in that safe. There are definitely some parallels, like the elite mercenary group and the sort of.
It starts off like Die Hard, the one man army. You know,
a good one man army movie. They both sort of blend sort of comedy and violence very well. Very well, and they're both contained, right? You know, there's no getting off, there's no running away from the situation that's happening. If you were,
you have a very good point that Hans Gruber is not nuking Hawaii. Yeah,
so. I think I also agree that I like lots of the reviews I read. They say that is Die Hard on a boat. I think it is if all you're looking at is that like you say, like the one man army thing. But I think there's enough difference that I think that's like a cheap comparison. I don't think that John McClane and Casey Ryback are like anything alike.
Oh, they're definitely not cut from the same cloth.
John McClane like gets his ass kicked and like almost gets killed like numerous times. The only time Casey like even gets hurt is because he has to like swim to the middle of the ocean to put a bomb on his sub. But other than that, like I think Casey's just like more elite than John McClane in terms of eliminating the threats. Yeah. And I just think, yeah, like Hans and what's his name? Stranix. They're like vastly different.
True. True. You guys beat me. We've got the Playboy lady that has motion sickness, so she's given some gravel to calm her stomach. And we got the big party going on, and we end up seeing Gary Busey in a dress, so you can sleep with that image tonight.
and again, like, he does it so well. There's like this sort of manic energy that he brings to it, and the enlisted men are loving it, and the other officers are kind of like horrified by what he's doing, but then sort of come around to the sort of comedy of it. And I think it's he plays this part so well. I mean, you know, the fact that he is kind of crazy. They got him a good time before he completely derailed into the crazy Gary Busey. Just had, I guess, enough of a handle on it to be crazy and deliver a great, great performance.
So now we do end up finding out that this group is like a private hired group of mercenaries that is, you know, goes out there and infiltrates certain situations. Do they always pose as a band?
I think they're like Dutch. They're like Dutch's group of Predator.
Yeah. Yeah, but they all have to know how to play an instrument too.
I mean, that's a great point. The food looks excellent as well. Like, clearly they know
how to cook. Casey's not the only cook. Yeah, these guys can. It must be a skill that you learn in mercenary school, right? I mean,
the setting up the sound systems and the lighting for bands as well, you know, technical stuff. They know how to do it, I guess.
I do also like the threat of, you know, let that be a lesson to you. I will kill you and the man next to you. That's a real good way to drive the point home, is like, oh shit.
Yeah, that switch of gears is great, where he says he gets the highest ranking officer to stand up in the room and then shoots him in the forehead. And
that too, yeah.
What a fantastic moment, like in terms of like, and Tommy Lee Jones switches as well too, from being this sort of jovial, happy, backslapping, entertaining guy to suddenly like laser serious, sort of laser pointed and serious to he's taking over now, and everything switches so fast. And just one criticism from that scene, though, is when they fire the submachine gun in the room there, firing in an all metal contained environment like that. I don't think that they would have just hit what they wanted to hit. I think there would be ricochets like zipping all over the place.
Yeah, I'm sure. Probably. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that hull is strong enough to deflect bullets.
But it makes for a great, shocking intro, for sure. You're kind of with the crew, like, what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that jarring, Colin, is that you mentioned that you didn't see this coming, that the mercenaries were, that the caterer guys were the mercenaries.
Yeah, because I was watching like the concert, and like Tommy Lee Jones is like, you know, he's like on stage and singing and stuff, and you know, looking like he's having a good time. And then when that like switch happened, I was just like, whoa, like I was very surprised. And then even when like I knew that Krill was gonna be a bad guy, but I didn't expect them to kill the captain. I thought it was gonna be like the captain is held hostage and like Ryback has to go save him, basically like that type of movie. So when they
Yeah.
just like completely off him right from the get, I was like, well, I
I
was
guess if
surprised.
you're the highest ranking person left on board, then it's not necessarily a mutiny. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. My like probably biggest criticism of this movie is that, so like we're expected to believe, I think, because like the party is going on, like that Jordan is in the cake the entire time. But then
Right?
like, and like you would think like, oh, like I could understand if like when Casey finds her, like he finds her and she's scared and terrified and hiding or whatever. But when it's like he opens the door and like swings the cake out and the music hits and she just like comes out and start, I would just be like, where were you? Like, what were you like? You were taking it, where are you expected to, like, it's so bad that they even in movie try to like explain it. Like, they at least do us the courtesy of having Ryback be like, yeah, that's crazy. Like, what were you doing in here? And she's like trying to, but like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it just,
Well, the
I don't know
only
how
thing
you
that
don't.
worked for me in that situation is we see her take 5 pills when she's told to take 2. So I could believe that they knocked her on her ass for a bit. However, the fact that she is still ready to go as soon as that music hits, that's the part that's a little bit unbelievable in that. I could believe maybe she nodded off in that cake for a couple minutes, though.
I guess so. Maybe it's just like when it moves, she was like, "Oh, what? Oh shit, it's time!" And then she just like,
Yeah. But boy, oh boy, that scene. Oh my God, that's one that I remember quite well as a child. I mean, 14-year-old Sean, I mean, we got boobs.
yeah.
And I've read one of the pieces of trivia says at the time this film was a huge hit in video rental shops on VHS tapes. However, the stores had to continually replace their copies as Eric Galanian's striptease sequence was frequently worn out from being constantly rewound and replayed by viewers. So,
I can believe it. I can believe it. I dare say that the VHS copy I had may have grown somewhat corrupted during that exact scene.
Has a bit of a soft spot in the middle of that tape there,
It
huh?
comes a little,
Yeah.
you know, scratchy when you're playing it. So
That in the
short.
basic instinct cassette. Yeah, it is a short scene, but I mean, to 14-year-old Sean, that was an eternity.
Just pause. Yeah, it's all right, you know. I've seen better.
My wife, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess Steven Seagal also, here's another thing that is trying to keep it like accurate is he doesn't have his ponytail because of the fact that the Navy doesn't allow a hair longer than 4 inches.
Was wondering about that. I was wondering
Yeah.
if this, if there was like a pre-ponytail Steven Seagal. I thought he always had it, but.
Yeah. Like how long does that take him to grow back? I mean, you gotta feel bad for that guy. He was probably working on it for years.
Did anyone else notice when they were watching that scene with the cake that I don't know if it's like I just imagined it or but he seems to go in for a grope just before it cuts away. Did anyone else notice that or
Well, he's putting a
I thought he
jacket on
went to
her,
put the
isn't he?
jacket
Oh,
on.
you
Yeah,
think he was
he's
putting
putting.
the jacket on? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe that's
Yeah.
what he
I
was.
mean, again, knowing what I know about Steven Seagal, I wouldn't be completely surprised if that was the case. Whoa, you
Yes.
can't show those in here. Let me cover them up with my hands.
Yeah, I didn't know that about him because in this movie I was like, oh, he seems like such a consummate gentleman, just covering her up and, you know, not
That's
taking
right.
advantage of her until I guess the end of the movie for whatever reason.
Yeah. I was surprised with this movie how little of this Steven Seagal movie actually has Steven Seagal in it. They really focus on the bad guy story a lot in this movie.
So Tommy Lee Jones has more screen time than Steven Seagal in the movie. And
Yeah.
I'm a great believer that, you know, an action hero is only as good as his as the bad guy, right? And
yeah.
Stranix is just a phenomenal bad guy throughout this movie, just like in Die Hard. You know, perhaps that's one of the other reasons that people draw that parallel with Die Hard is because
the bad guy is
such a strong, interesting character.
Yeah. And it's also just weird in this day and age with where Tommy Lee Jones has gone in his career to think that in this movie, Gary Busey has billing over Tommy Lee Jones. Like, it's... it just seems odd, right?
Yeah. They made the right choice focusing on Tommy Lee Jones in this movie. Like, without that character, if Krill was just the main guy, this movie would be so bad. Like, Stranix, just like his, I don't know, the performance is just, what's a good word, like dynamic, I guess, is what comes to mind. Like, where it's just, you really don't know what he's going to do next. And there are even like times like where like, it was like when he shoots the, I was like, oh, I can't believe he actually shot the missiles off. Like, normally the bad guy would get stopped before they do that. So like, now what's going to happen? And like, there are so many times where I thought he was going to be stopped, or like the story itself would like intervene to like make the good guy save the day when it didn't. That, yeah, it was interesting.
Well, and then when he's also telling stories about his favorite episode of The Muppets, you know, like at the same, you know, it's like, yeah, this guy, you don't know where he's coming from with anything. Like, that's what the whole shrimp story is. I remember that episode of The Muppets, like the Swedish chef taking it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome how unhinged he becomes once he gets that, I guess, the tinnitus, or he's exposed to that explosion from the cannon firing, how he sort of again sort of transforms. And then you see sort of scaring the men that work for him, because he's just clearly completely lost his mind and is babbling and ranting and talking about cartoons and, you know, threatening them with guns and stuff. And
they do a good job with Stranix of like, he comes in like unhinged, but like in complete control of the situation. And they do a good job of like, not quickly, but like slowly showing that he's realizing he's losing more and more control. And then how that like further elevates his level of unhingedness.
Well, and I even love how at first it's kind of like, okay, sure, that's a problem, but we got this, we'll do this now. And it's just like, as each like new problem, like, yes, I just love though how like at first he's, yeah, okay, we got this, we don't need that piece, we're okay without that, you know, like stuff like that. It just, yeah, but as he devolves, yes, it's as like each piece is falling away from his plan.
I also like that sort of insight you get into like how when Krill tells Stranix his plan to start drowning the men in the front of the ship, and he's like just starts laughing. It's like, that's a great plan. You know, like he clearly has a very sadistic, cruel undertone that's sort of revealed in that moment too. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta ask whether you think it would take that long for them to wake up a president. They shoot down the plane. They gather all the people in the war room, and then they like make a phone call and they talk to him on the ship. And that's when they realize that they've got a problem. Don't you think the president would have been woken up with the F-18 being shot down by a U.S. ship?
I love that moment, too, where, you know, the ship comes in and says, and the pilot says, am I being locked on? And they say no, and then shoot him down. Anyway,
yeah.
It's such a, again, like a very sort of, you know, these guys are calculating, cruel, cold. They're gonna do whatever it takes to get this done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also like that, you know, that we got an explanation where they got this helicopter from, was that they've stolen it. And so now there's people looking for the helicopter, which is why the F-18 or the F-14 comes out to the ship. It's they're trying to figure out what happened to the helicopter that was the Chinook that was obviously hijacked somewhere.
Yeah.
It's the same with the sub, right? They like pass this story about like when the one guy in the war room is telling the story about Stranix and how he like the last mission his team did was like take out some North Korean sub, and they said they're like, oh no, we're pretty sure it's sunk. But that's the sub, right? Like that's we're meant to think like that's the sub that they have, right? Okay, that I wasn't clear on.
There's definitely like something I appreciated about this movie too, is there's quite a sort of lot of logic and sequence that you don't normally get in action movies. You know, sort of things that are explained, and then they, in at least in their own little world, kind of make sense. The audience is coming along
with this.
Like, where do they get a submarine? From a mission. This is it. And then, you know, it's kind of sequential. And I appreciate that. And the audience isn't patronized in a way. Like nothing's like oversold or overemphasized. We just kind of see things sort of play out.
Yeah, I think the only time the audience is patronized is when Ryback and Stranix finally meet and they had to put in the line about, like, we're just puppets. We're just puppets, you and me. We just get pulled by the strings of men above us. I was like, oh, God.
I actually quite enjoyed that little speech. I thought the more patronizing bit was like the completely unnecessary of them knowing each other from somewhere. You know, like, oh, I know you, that's how you do. And it was like, oh, that wasn't necessary. Come
Do I
on,
know
come
you?
on. Yeah.
Well, apparently that was supposed to be a scene that was never filmed. There was supposed to be a different scene that opened this movie that kind of explained an old mission that happened.
Oh.
Yeah, so there was supposed to be a real connection to so, but otherwise that line just kind of goes out there and hangs there of don't I know you? You look familiar. Like it's just this weird moment is what it ends up being.
Yeah.
So he's got his sidekick now. He's picked up his hooker, or not his hooker. Sorry, that's rude of me. His stripper. He's picked up his stripper, and so now he has a sidekick. I love just the machismo of Steven Seagal. He's gonna lock her in lockers, and you know this is the safest place for you to be. No, it's not. What if the like, you know, sure they might not look for her in the locker, but you know you don't know what's gonna happen to the ship.
Yeah, if the ship sinks, that would be a terrible place to be.
One of the
Walking in a
worst. You
locker.
wouldn't
Yeah,
see it
probably one of the
coming.
worst. Yeah, I actually really enjoy how this sort of sets out, you know, the initially they seem to sort of develop a sort of reluctant brother-sister relationship. You know, he's like, oh, fine, I'll take you along, you know, and it seems to work. Like it seems to be a good dynamic. There's kind of sort of brother-sister chemistry there that is very enjoyable at the outset.
And I
It's also
mean,
incredibly
I can.
convenient that, you know, in the following scenes that he also had in his locker, amongst the other things that he needed, some combat fatigues for a small, busty female. It's just very lucky that he was able to supply her with those things happened to be in his locker too. I've
Yeah.
thought on a rewatch.
Well, you never know when you're going to need a smaller size than you would actually wear. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, black. Yeah, combat fatigues. Yeah, I guess.
Okay, so I may have missed. Why did they decide to blow up the helicopter instead of
So I
doing
think the
anything
reason
else with
he
her?
did that was to prevent them from to try and stop them from escaping off the ship.
Okay.
I think that his thinking behind that was so that they the after the because he doesn't know, you know, he's sort of figuring things out too. That's why he's sort of creeping around and trying to figure out what they're up to and why what they're doing. And so I think that he was probably did that for probably one of two reasons. One was to prevent them escaping after they completed their mission, and also to clear the space for the SEALs to come and fast rope down to get
Okay,
onto
yeah.
the ship.
Just because Jordan has a point. I mean, they could escape
Yeah.
with it. But I guess Steven Seagal's daughter was on set that day and but wasn't allowed to watch the helicopter explode. And
Very
this
reminiscent of
and
Die Hard 2 when he jumps off the suspended by a rope and it blows up. It's a great scene. That explosion is fantastic when it he can't run back from the direction he came and then has to jump off the other side. The helicopter explodes behind him is awesome.
That is a really cool scene, yeah. I mean, they definitely go for it as much as they can in this movie. Yeah. The submarine is the other one. I do like the planting the explosive on the submarine.
Yeah, and I like the way that, you know, again as a character, it's like he doesn't know everything. He doesn't know what he's kind of trying to figure the stuff out. You know, he isn't able to warn the Navy SEALs coming in because he doesn't know about the helicopter. It's not in play. You know, he's sort of disabled, or he knows that the ship's weapon systems are disabled. And then when the helicopters are coming in, he doesn't know that there's a submarine that the bad guys can intercept the Apache and the SEALs with. And I thought that that was a good sort of like twist for him to witness, like, oh, you know, there's a additional stuff going on here.
Yeah, we thought you stopped us, but we've got bazookas. Yeah. I know I as a kid, I definitely didn't understand everything that they were doing with welding these beams to the ceiling and everything like that. I like how they don't explain it at first, and then Steven Seagal comes in with the explanation near the end that they're making rails, 'cause I had no idea up until his explanation.
And it's not super clear what they're doing. It's sort of suspending a massive beam with a jagged edge cut on it, and just from the rope, dangling down from a rope that rather
With a
conveniently
hitch knot?
with a hitch knot on it.
With a hitch knot. Yeah, that's one of the coolest deaths in the movie, though.
Yes,
Oh,
that's my
that's a good
favorite one
one.
for sure.
Yeah. There's 100 deaths in this movie. But they have as fun with so many of them. I mean, they're cutting people up with bandsaws. They're,
We get a throat rip. We haven't seen that since Roadhouse.
We haven't seen that, but boy, it's not a very good throat rip. The
No.
Roadhouse one was so much gorier.
The bandsaw scene, funny enough, really stayed with me for another reason, which was when I was a kid, we used to take family vacations in Colorado. And when we were there, the Under Siege was playing in the afternoon on the TV, or like on the mainstream TV. So my brothers and I were watching it. And something that really surprised me was they removed the cake scene for American TV, but the VHS copy I had in the UK did not have the guy being pushed into the bandsaw. So for the first time, I saw that scene where the guy's picked up and pushed into the bandsaw, and it cuts into his neck.
Okay.
And it completely caught me by surprise because I hadn't seen it before. I didn't know that scene existed, but it really carried forward with me like American morality, right? They blur out bare breasts, but it's in the middle of the afternoon. It's absolutely fine to see somebody being pushed into a being murdered with a bandsaw.
Oh yeah, the double standards of the like what we find offensive compared to Americans compared, it just it blows my mind. Like it's yeah, it can't have boobs.
Yeah, can't
We
have
can
boobs,
saw
but
this man in half.
in the middle of the afternoon, yeah, no problem at all.
I mean, John Mulaney has a joke about like having SVU on in the middle of the day and some of the things that are said on that. Yeah, it's true. I mean, middle of the day, you can be talking about some very disgusting things if it's in the form of a medical show or a cop show or whatever. Okay, now how does he get the timing exactly right on his microwave bomb, by the way?
I'm so glad you raised that, Sean. That is definitely one of the sort of things that even as a teenager, when I was really like fanboying out in this movie, I couldn't figure out how he got the beeping to stop exactly just before the explosion went off, and that they just walked in the room at that, they were in the room at that exact moment.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I also love how like tactically this room happens to be right in the middle of the ship with access to everything. So, it's he's got the perfect place to be based.
Yeah, very, very convenient. Although I find a lot of this movie very logical, some stuff is very convenient and lucky.
Yeah. Well, like still having old shells on board from the, like World War II. And also someone that knows how to use the equipment.
And it just so happens
Oh, we also have a
that,
World War II vet on board. How convenient. I love his ragtag group that he's got. He's got, the laundry guy.
yeah.
He's got the World War II vet.
When he goes to rescue those
Band of
guys and
misfits.
sort of rallies them to take him with him, that is quite, again, not something I haven't seen in another Seagal movie where he sort of delivers a speech to rally people and then they sort of come around and get on board. It was
Yeah,
quite
it's
a
an
neat little
adventure.
scene. Yeah, it's an adventure.
Ultimately, after he goes around basically ki killing everybody that is a bad guy, he ends up in a knife fight with Tommy Lee Jones. Like I said, he walks into that room. Tommy Lee Jones has the drop on him. Why does he decide to let him live?
Hubris.
Hubris, yeah. You know what a problem he's been.
But what follows is arguably one of the greatest knife fight scenes in any action movie ever. It is,
Yeah.
I can't think of one that's better from an action movie.
Colin, the look on your face, I think you're about to
I've got something to say,
disagree with
Colin. Let's
this.
have it.
All right, I'm gonna bring up another Tommy Lee Jones movie called The Hunted with Benicio del Toro. Have you seen that movie?
I'm very familiar with that movie, yes. Yeah.
All
I have
right.
not, no.
I would say almost every knife fight in that scene, that movie is better than this
Well, I mean, some of those scenes are kind of like a little absurd in that movie. Like the length of those times those knife fights go on for too. It's like they're
Yeah,
having like 20 minute knife fights, whereas this one
sure.
seems to be sort of neatly wrapped up in like a minute and a half. But yeah.
My only issue with the one in this movie is that I don't know if Steven Seagal's like The Rock, where he has like very specific like I can't be an evil man, I can't lose a fight type clauses in his contract, but he takes like one cut to the eye, like above the eye, whereas like Tommy Lee Jones is getting his like wrist slit, his eyes gouged, his like chest cut. Like it just didn't seem like a very competitive match
Yeah.
for a final fight.
That's a good point. I also feel that when he bites the knife out of his hand with his mouth, the sharp side in his mouth, how that didn't cut his, like the number of times I've cut myself with a kitchen knife and reaching into a drawer, the idea that he grabs it with his teeth and it doesn't cut his mouth like the Joker is just, I didn't,
Guess
that
how I
kind of
got
detracted
these
from it a
scars?
little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the eye gouge and then the knife right through the top of the head is some fantastic violence. That was through the prosthetic
I
head.
liked that. I liked that. I did think it was cool. I thought it was like a cool move to bite the knife, but I don't think it looked as cool on film as they hoped it would. Like it just, yeah, that scene, maybe they could have used an extra take or something. But I did think it was epic that he stabs him like right in the top of the skull and throws him through that computer monitor or whatever it is for good measure.
Well, you and I mean, of course, the before he puts him through the monitor, he brings a thumb to that knife fight and gouges his eye out.
I will say, as much as I really enjoyed the scene where they like take over that missile launching thing and like take out the submarine, but I was really really hoping that we were going to get like a more close up Ryback versus Krill death, like kill Krill death scene, not have him just get blown up from afar, just because he was such an asshole to him at the beginning.
He and but I am impressed with this movie not having a wet and half charred Krill come up behind him in the final scene or something, you know? Yeah, because that's what they did with Gary Busey in Lethal Weapon.
It definitely did a great job of adding some tension too. Like you think that they might get away, or they figured out a plan to get away, and it looks like it's just about to work, and then they can hear the shell coming in for the final hit. Unfortunately, again, not super realistic. It's my understanding that to use those guns, it takes 93 people. So and also like they're also technically brilliant with the loading it and the intercoms and the only advice direction they're given is be careful with that powder, or like push it gently. Is
He's a Navy SEAL. He can do anything.
I mean, it seems that way. He can cook. He can he knows how to. I don't know what day of buds they learned how to steam explosives out of a shell and.
I couldn't help but feel watching this movie that Steven Seagal has, I feel like, some sort of like Gumby leg kicking ability. Like the way he can just go from like straight standing to executing like a roundhouse kick is, I don't know. It defies logic and physics, I feel.
I mean, in 92.
Sure.
Ralph Macchio and William Zabka can still kick high these days. I don't think Steven Seagal is kicking above the waist anymore.
Yeah.
He definitely wasn't
Fair
when I
enough.
saw him last. I can tell you that. He definitely wasn't when I saw him last.
So ultimately, they saved the day. They managed to deactivate the tomahawk because a Navy SEAL is also a tech genius and can figure out how to do that. And of course, in the end, he kisses the girl, even though, there was absolutely no lead up to that whatsoever. But, she is a girl in this movie, and so that means that the lead has to kiss her.
Yeah, that really sort of the last sort of 15 seconds of the movie that where he kisses her, I really, they'd had this sort of brother sister dynamic and it had been so enjoyable, and then it kind of like it's kind of cringy, and then the next scene she's in like a sailor's uniform and it's like
Yeah,
what
that's
at the
why
funeral.
is our 1989 play July Miss July, why is she suddenly a sailor?
Yeah, movie logic, I guess. And she's not wearing
Just
the hat.
honorary.
Yeah, she must be because like this funeral would have also happened fairly quickly. So you're telling me that she joined the Navy, got like, recruited enough that she can be at this funeral in Navy uniform,
But doesn't have
like
to wear a
in
hat.
what?
Yeah,
Yeah, in like a week?
I know another criticism of that closing scene too is that apparently his medals and stuff are on the wrong side and are all wonky and wrong. And yeah, people who are in the Navy just hate that closing scene because of his uniform.
Steven Seagal looked at himself in the mirror and he goes, "It's on the right side."
He has a sort of limp-wristed salute. It's I don't know what happened.
He's in mourning.
Yeah, 45 seconds of the movie there, but it really took away from it that once I found that stuff out. So.
Yeah. But there we go, the end. Except, what does Luke know about the post-credit scene?
I don't know about the post-credit scene.
What?
Oh man, I didn't watch the post-credit scene.
Yeah, it's nothing exciting, but it does. There is at the very end, it comes back up and shows you just the USS Missouri, and it tells you the real story about when it was decommissioned. Just words come up on the screen and that's it. It is a very brief end credit scene, but it would be the kind of thing that plays just before the credits roll when you've got a movie based on a true story. This is one where they decide to flash you one little bit of, it's like a pop-up video. It's this one last little taste of, hey, by the way, this was a real ship we were talking about the whole movie. So post-credit scene in Under Siege.
Wow, I missed it. I mean, it doesn't sound quite as good as the ones from the Marvel movies or anything like that.
No, not really, no. No, no. But I am still, once again, just blown away by the amount of post-credit scenes I've found on this show pre-Marvel movies, just because I've decided to watch till the end. I have found so many. But there we go, that is Under Siege. Now, Colin, Luke, on IMDb, it scored 6.5 out of 10, has a Metascore of 58 on Rotten Tomatoes. This blows my mind. 80% on the tomato meter. The critics on Rotten Tomatoes love this movie. And an audience rating of 62%. This is one of only three Steven Seagal movies that have a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And the other two are Executive Decision and Machete. And he has very small roles in both of those. So, yeah, this is the freshest of all of Steven Seagal's movies. But Colin, those are just numbers. Roundhouse kick to the face. Hit us with some reviews.
All right, Dan the Man 2 says 4 out of 5 stars. I've been putting off watching any Steven Seagal film for the longest time, but it was a family movie night and my mother's pick, so I guess watching one of his films was inevitable. Truth be told, I'm glad it was Under Siege of all his films, because beneath the whole Die Hard on a ship selling point, it is a generally great and oh-so-campy action thriller. Seagal can't act plain and simple, so director Andrew Davis and crew employed a similar trick used by the Die Hard guys when Bruce Willis wasn't available due to his commitment to the TV show Moonlighting, and beefed up the supporting roles in order to make them more memorable. What this means is that we get villains in the form of Tommy Lee Jones and Gary Busey, turned up to a tongue-in-cheek 11 with wild-card Cole Meany to boot, making Seagal's self-important intensity even funnier than it should be, but also rendering the film with little stakes knowing he'll always come out on top. The bottom line for Under Siege is that its hero is a wooden plank who slaps people with an otherwise brilliantly staged, scored, shot, and fun film built around him.
You know, the funny thing is, all these references to Die Hard, I did read that the success of this film delayed the third Die Hard movie, because originally the third Die Hard movie was going to be about a cruise ship taken over by terrorists, and this movie was so successful, they're like, this will be Under Siege Die Hard version, so we got to change it, and so they changed to Die Hard with a Vengeance, which, when we did that episode, you may remember, was a Lethal Weapon script that was turned into Die Hard with a Vengeance. So it's just kind of funny how Die Hard 3 could have been so many different things.
Nice.
Alan M says, or Elaine M says, 2.5 out of 5. Rewatching this in 2023 makes you realize what bad of an actor Steven Seagal actually was. He couldn't carry an action movie. This movie is only there to boost his ego and his prowess with a martial art that doesn't look anything nearly as spectacular as the one that JCVD shows off shows off on screen, or Keanu Reeves for that matter, who is also incomparable when it comes to acting. Steven might be full of himself, but this box office, one of the few to his name, is mediocre at best.
I wonder if part of the reason why you don't get the usual Steven Seagal fist fighting or whatever, like his usual martial arts, is because it is such a contained environment. Like, it's hard to stretch out and do a lot of stuff when you're in such small, confined spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good observation, Sean. Like, there's not space for mats and people being tossed around big distances or thrown across, you know, lots of tables.
That's why you have to have a knife fight where it's just, like, forearm versus forearm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This one's 4 out of 5 stars, a solid 90s action flick in Seagal's finest hour. The first 20 minutes is a bit cheesy and over the top, but once the ship takeover happens, it takes a solid jump up and never lets up. The shootouts and practical effects are all really well done and easily the highlight. The ship setting is memorable and does a good job holding tension, and it doesn't get too complicated ever to follow. It's basically Die Hard on a ship, and that's a good thing.
Jeez.
The acting isn't bad, but definitely the weakest part while everything else is solid. Seagal has more life here than in any other performance, but it's still a two steps below Keanu Reeves. Tommy Lee Jones is the best thing in a hammed up, over-the-top performance that is really good and makes for a great ensemble villain cast. Everyone else is just kind of forgettable. None of the characters have much depth to them at all. Also, not sure why Jones doesn't just shoot Seagal after knowing how dangerous he is and encountering him before also.
Thank
it
you.
Also does, it also does start to run out of steam a bit in the final 10 to 15 minutes, but it ends well. The knife fight is a bit over the top, but still. Anyone who is a fan of 90s action, any actors in this, the director or Seagal especially, will enjoy this.
You know, Luke, I will apologize right now and say I am so sorry I ever called this Die Hard on a ship, because after hearing this many people say that, I feel like that was such a basic bitch observation to make. That you're right, this is, as much as I love Die Hard, this is so much more than Die Hard on a ship, and so I am sorry for that.
Well, you don't have to apologize yet. It's
well, hey, let's throw in a couple more. Matthew Lally sends the 4 out of 5 stars. Definitely the best Steven Seagal movie. The reason the movie works so well is that you have Andrew Davis directing, who managed to turn what could have been a poor imitation of Die Hard on a ship into a top-quality action movie. This is the perfect case of padding out the star of the movie with top actors and getting a director who can add great atmosphere and fantastic action scenes to proceedings. It's a 95-minute runtime. Also, make sure it doesn't overstay its welcome. Well-made action entertainment.
Yeah.
And then lastly, 5 out of 5, Under Siege is one of the most popular Steven Seagal action movies. While it might be labeled Die Hard on a Battleship, it's not a copy of Die Hard. Plus, the writing is also quite strong, and so are the action sequences where Seagal excels. From breakneck martial arts fights to solid gunfights to cool explosions, this film has it all. There you go.
Right on. Oh boy, Under Siege.
Wow.
Yeah, this is... It's been so long since I've visited anything with Steven Seagal in it that it was a treat to see him. I'm glad that this action month that we're doing has brought a Steven Seagal movie onto I Used to Like This One. And as far as Steven Seagal goes, it is a good one. Brain Candy. It's such a mindless, great action flick that I still laugh at the fact that I love a Steven Seagal movie, but it is good. And as an adult, I got so much more out of it than just a naked lady than I did when I was 14. So it's a good story. It's a well-done movie. Steven Seagal, just, I still can't take him seriously no matter what. I never can, but it's a good flick, and I like the performances in it from everyone else especially. Let's throw it to Luke. I mean, Luke, I think I know what you're going to say, but on this viewing.
I'm glad that you threw it to me before you threw it to Colin, because I might completely lose my mind, depending on what Colin has to say about this movie, and attacks my childhood and my identity. But no, there's definitely criticisms of this movie. I'm really glad that this movie was picked. It was super fun. I don't think I've seen this movie for about 10 years. And like you, watching it again later on, definitely, maybe longer than that, maybe 15 years, definitely I was able to enjoy it on a whole bunch of different levels that weren't just Erica And you know, there's a lot about this movie to enjoy. Like, I was sort of writing a list of things like this: cinematography and the lighting is fantastic. You know, as he moves through the kitchen, you can tell it tinkered with the lights, so he's sort of like a sort of almost like a predator, sort of when he's interacting with the crew or whatever, with Krill, and when he's skulking around in the dark after the when the mercenaries come shoot the marine.
Yeah, it's a cool environment to shoot in, for sure.
It's a cool, unique environment, and the casting I thought was almost flawless. The characters are so fun and have so much chemistry between them, whether it's Stranix and Krill, or you know, the brother sister relationship between Seagal and Erica. And unlike a lot of movies, action movies, I kind of enjoyed the sort of logic and the sequence, and the pacing is really good. And there's constant little comedic jabs and jokes in it throughout that I thought was really fun. Like, even you know, just that scene where Frill is exposed to the cannon fire. I don't know if you notice, he like falls down as he's sort of walking away, and it's almost like a sort of pratfall, and he sort of gets up and he goes. I think it's a fantastic movie. Now, some of the criticisms, of course, I have of it are, as I said, the kiss at the end of the movie, the uniforms aren't quite right,
bouillabaisse,
the grabbing of the knife with the teeth and the open mouth. But I just really enjoyed it as a rewatch. To me, this movie definitely stands up all this time later. Was totally enjoyable, and yeah. I'm really glad that it was we got to watch it again.
Right on. Well, there we go. Now, Colin, are you about to shit all over it? What did you think of Under Siege?
All right. No, I loved it, man. I thought it was great. And it was unfortunately, I didn't watch a lot of like 80s and 90s, like these like kind of like popcorn action flicks. I was like blown away even looking at this. Like, it was nominated for, I saw like two Academy Awards, which blew my mind. I didn't know the box office until today, but that was mind-blowing to me. I do think that in my mind this is a Tommy Lee Jones movie. I kind of like, I was so impressed and just blown away by his performance, just kind of like, you know, like seeing him as he is now. And I mean, I guess like Men in Black isn't far removed from this movie. It's like 95.
Yeah,
it's right. So like,
no, it's 98.
Oh, 98. Yeah. It's, 'cause that was like my first real memory of Tommy Lee Jones, that in Two-Face. And so it's kind of just like watching this movie. That guy has so much, he blows my mind because he's on face value, he seems like so like one note. But when he performs, he fits like wherever. It's crazy. I don't know. He's just so good. But yeah, I enjoyed this movie a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought Steven Seagal was super cool. And it was just like...
You don't have to say that.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. I thought like... I'm glad of, because I do remember liking Half Past Dead.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it in years though. But... I was glad to kind of, I don't know, I feel like this movie gives you like a good idea of what Steven Seagal is about.
Yeah. It's fun in the way that Roadhouse and Point Break were. Like, that's the kind of level of movie. As successful as it was, I can't take it more seriously than something like Roadhouse. But it's just fun.
Yeah. It's just a fun movie. I love, like that one review said, I think, because it's only 90 minutes, like you just get into it real fast, and the action is good, and yeah, it's just a fun cat and mouse action movie. I really enjoyed it. I would watch it again.
Would you watch Under Siege 2, Dark Territory?
No, because I heard it's garbage, which I think is like such a missed opportunity. Like, when I finished watching this movie, I was like, I feel like Steven Seagal or these directors, production team, whatever it is, like missed the boat. Like, I feel like you could have made 10 of these, of just this guy just going like, I don't know. And even like nowadays, I feel like, not that, I guess it's kind of too generic to make it anything that would have like name recognition, but it's very like reminiscent of like a, like Jack Reacher or, you know, those types of like John Grisham or whatever, like those, like even like Jack Ryan, like those like spy novels. Yeah. Taken, like where you could just have this guy who's basically like a real life super soldier. And it's just, you know, he's going after whatever, I don't know, nefarious government spy deal is there is of the day. But I don't know. That stuff is just fun. It's so fun.
Cooking his way around the world.
Yeah, that could be his whole thing. He gets hired to be, it always starts with him being hired to be some sort of like executive chef. And then problems just.
Isn't that how the White House Down movies, like, isn't there a whole series of those?
London has fallen and like Olympus has fallen
Olympus
and all
has
that.
fallen. So there you go. It could have been Steven Seagal. It would have been like Gerard Butler. Who? No, Steven Seagal protects the president. Steven Seagal protects the queen. That's what's going on.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, I guess, that the second one was so bad because I feel like clearly people loved this movie when it came out. So I could the disappointment for the second one must have been like overwhelming because most sequels can like get by on a little bit, but it's pretty unanimous that Under Siege 2 is absolute garbage.
Yeah, I mean, watching this movie for the first time was, I wanted to be Casey Ryback. And then I watched the when Under Siege 2 came out, I was so excited for it, and I was like, okay, I've got to put this behind me. I need to be somebody else.
Well, there we go. That is Under Siege, and that's our show for this week. Oh boy, a big, huge thank you to our special guest, Luke Bartoszek. Luke, thanks for coming and sharing your embarrassing history with this movie.
Feel free to edit any of it out. But
Oh,
no, thank you for having
not at
me.
all.
It's always a blast.
If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out, well, just go tell somebody. Word of mouth is so important. It just helps spread the word of the show, and then more people are listening to it. That's how it works. That's just how things work. Or if you want to go above and beyond, you could go over to whatever app you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. Give us a little review, and 5 stars just help drive us up the charts, help us get noticed. Use those funky algorithms of iTunes to just help the show. Or if you want to go even further and donate to the show and become a producer, go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and you become part of the Patreon family and you get a shout out, just like executive producer Joshua Blum at the 13th Hour Podcast.
And be sure to check out our website, IUsedToLikeThisOne.com, where you can find links to all of our podcast episodes and social media pages. Drop us a line at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on the show.
Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Oh boy, Colin. I mean, Luke just said it that, he was worried that you were going to dump all over a part of his childhood. Next week, I mean, we're out of action month. We're into sci-fi, even though it's kind of all been blending together. But next week, I get to dump on a little bit of your childhood. I mean,
Well, you can try.
tell us what we got coming up next here.
We have the 1995 classic Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie.
The movie, that's
It's
right. I'm sorry.
Morphin time, baby.
It's Morphin time. Make my babies grow, all that sort of stuff. Power Rangers, I mean, I've said it many times on the show, but I'm a little aged out of Power Rangers. My little brother was a fan of Power Rangers, so it was around in the house, but I wasn't a big fan of this. So this is me, like, hopefully getting a chance to get some revenge for Luke. No, actually, you love this movie, so there is no revenge needed. No, I'm excited about this because, like, I always saw Power Rangers on the periphery, so I wasn't hugely invested, but I know a thing or two about a Power Ranger. But I mean, I know you got stories. Like, you're just Mr. Power Ranger over there, so.
Yeah, I would say Power Rangers is my numero uno fandom. So,
Over wrestling, even.
yeah, I'd say for me it's Power Rangers, then like a mix between bat like I'll go comics and say Batman, X-Men, and then wrestling. Those would be my top threes.
Interesting. Well, I can't wait. So until next time, when we do Mighty Morphin Power Rangers the movie, I'm Sean Wells.
I'm Colin Stewart.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you then on I Used to Like This One.